Hi, you're listening to my favourite Elliott Smith song. In this podcast, we do our bit to keep Elliott Smith's legacy alive by speaking to well-known fans about their favourite song of his. So hi, and welcome to the show. Sorry that it's been a little while since we last put out an episode, but I hope you've been keeping well in the meantime. Today, we'll start by hearing from Charlie Campbell, who used to play in Portland band Pond during the 1990s. Charlie's band played with Elliott on numerous occasions in the city, and Heat Miser also supported them on a tour of Texas too. In our interview, we spoke to Charlie about that tour. We spoke about his favourite song pick, of course, and he also mentioned one or two regrets about the time that he spent with Elliott. In addition to that chat, we'll also hear from a slightly different Portland artist, the Portland Cello Project. This group released a record of Elliott Smith covers back in 2014, and that album features the song that Charlie chose too. Rounding this all off, we'll also have a listener pick, and we'll share some more details about the 50th birthday tribute shows in August. And I promise we won't just be plugging our own one, though we'll probably do that too. Anyway, that's all been quite a long intro, so without any further ado, here's Charlie Campbell.
My name is Charlie Campbell. I live in Portland, Oregon. I was in a band called Pond in the 90s. There's another Pond now that when they took that name, we're just like, good luck, man. That's great. Have fun with it. I chose Needle in the Hay. I'm not sure why I chose that song. I just got your email and that song just started playing in my head. And I think it was the first Elliott song that sort of broke through to me. It's not his most accomplished finger-picking song, you know, that riff. I think if I, like back in then, if I played that little thing, I would not think that was a promising beginning. Like the themes of addiction or something, nothing particularly new about any of that. And yet, it's an amazing song that I'm still affected by, you know, decades later. That was what was special about him, I think. So the history with Elliott is, he was in Heat Miser and we were in a band called Pond. And we played a show downtown Portland at some kind of like metal club where they had like dance upstairs and shows in the basement. I'm sure some Portland listeners will probably remember the club. And it was just a weird place, and we played and they played. And I met Elliott that day, I think. And it didn't break through to me what he was doing. There was a song called Buick by Neil Gust that I was like, that's an amazing song. That's such a great song. And that's what I took away from watching them. But then we got to know them, and we got to know Elliott and became friends. And they supported us on the Southwest swing, like through Texas, through the south of the U.S. when one of Pond's tours. I guess I have a lot of regrets about that time with Elliott, because during that, he was a great guy, was sunny, you know, like just a fun guy to hang around. But that tour, he was suffering. And I don't know if that was the South or what it was, but he was not happy. It was probably 90, 94, 95, somewhere in there, maybe. I don't remember. And so he was suffering, and I did not know what that was about, and just, you know, he wasn't around as much. We heard vague things about stomach complaints, you know, and through a lot of that tour, he didn't seem to be happy. And, you know, just, I think we were busy doing other things where I was on a, I was consumed with my own stuff. And a few times with Elliott, I sort of wished I'd been more sensitive to whatever he was going through. You know, I imagine there's a lot of people that have regrets about their, you know, relationship with Elliott Smith.
Your hand on his arm, a stack charm around your neck, strung out and thin, calling some friend, trying to cash some check. He's acting dumb, that's what you've come to expect. Needle in the hay, needle in the hay.
Then at a certain point, Elliott said, hey, I'm doing this thing. I've recorded these songs. I think you might like them. They're sort of acoustic. He kind of explained it. And again, to my shame, I didn't really follow up with that. I didn't hear those things until I guess they sort of came out. And again, consumed with my own stuff. I don't think I was paying attention, you know, until this one show at Satyricon. He was opening for maybe Quasi, who I was really into, who I still love. So, and he played Satyricon. And I think it didn't feel crowded at that point. This is early, right? And he played that song. And it became obvious to me that there was something extremely special about what he was doing, right? And the beginning of that song is like, I remember thinking this way back then, it's nothing special. It's like sort of uneasy, actually. And maybe that's what he was expressing. But it was not like it's not his most accomplished finger picking song. It's not it didn't even feel like a riff. You know, this was the 90s. We looked for like the killer riff, right? he was not doing that. He was maybe expressing unease or something, but it did not sound like the promising beginning of a song, that little thing. It's just all downstrokes and kind of plain. But he takes that and he crafts it into this incredibly meaningful thing that, you know, I just think everybody was there knew was special.
It's wearing your clothes, head down to toes, a reaction to you. You say you know what he did, but you idiot kid, you don't have a clue. Sometimes they just get caught in the eye, you're pulling him through. Needle in the hay, needle in the hay, needle in the hay, needle in the hay.
So he was doing something that none of us were doing. We were, I think Portland, we were trying to be as loud as Seattle. My band was like poppier than the grunge label that we were on, Sub Pop. He just went 180 degrees another direction from what anybody was doing. And there are precedents, right, for that. But they go back ways in my mind, like Nick Drake. But since then, like, I just think so many artists owe so much to him. It became obvious, I think, to everybody pretty quickly that he was, maybe me later than others, that it was doing something that was really worth paying attention to.
There are lots of references to heroin in the song, but from what we read, we understand that Elliot wasn't using heroin at this stage of his life. So what do you think these references are about? Is he playing the role of sort of observer of a scene in Portland? And if so, was this a typical scene in the city at the time?
Sure. It may be so. It was sort of invisible to me. Like our story was the bass player and I came from Juneau, Alaska. And I think we're like right off the turnip truck from Juneau, Alaska. We're like really naive about a lot of things, I think. And I think we're oblivious to some, like vaguely aware of it. But I think just really naive about what other people were going through or experiencing and just wrapped up in our own thing. There were deaths. There were other people that we knew from that time did not make it out that died. I mean, later it became more of a problem because we had heroin addiction in our own band, right? And so later on, it was more obvious to people. But at that time, I was just naive about everything.
Now on the bus, nearly touching this dirty retreat. Falling out, six and pallet, dead sweat in my teeth. Gonna walk, 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 four more blocks, plus the one in my brain. Down, downstairs to the man, he's gonna make it all okay. I can't be myself, I can't be myself, and I don't wanna talk. I'm taking the cure so I can be quiet wherever I want. So leave me alone, you oughta be proud that I'm getting good marks.
Hey. guess I'll say this about it. I said that beginning of that song was maybe nothing special, right? But also lyrics about being strung out are not particularly special either. But he, Elliot, could take those things and make them into something that would be meaningful to so many people many years after. Like what we're doing right now is a testament, right, to that we're still talking about it, and I'm still interested in talking about it, is a testament to what he was able to do. And I think that's probably the mark of every great artist, right? They'll cover themes. There's no new themes, really, but he's doing them in a way that makes people feel something.
Do you remember the last time that you saw Elliot Smith?
The last time I saw Elliot was a show that we played in Silver Lake, I think, in L.A., and he came to the show, and at that point, he was pretty established. But he came up and he stood up front and he had a way of sort of like doing this sort of bending his knees, sort of kind of like little Elliot dance kind of thing, you know? And he just smiled through the whole thing. But this is awful. This is just me being stupid and naive and young or whatever. But I had read some things. I can't even remember if I read them or was told them, that he said in an interview about his old band. And I was friends with, you know, everybody in his old band, and I thought I was friends with him, and I didn't like it. I didn't like some of the stuff, and I should know, now I know better not to judge anybody by anything that appears in an interview, because there's no context, and you don't know how you don't know if they got it right. You don't know anything about it. It's just ridiculous. So he sat up there for the show, and then afterwards I greeted him. I don't think I greeted him particularly warmly, because I didn't like those things that he had said. And I never saw Elliot again. And so that was a long time before he died, right? But I'm sorry that was my last interaction with him. I'm really regretful, to my shame, that was my last interaction with him.
Thanks very much then to Charlie Campbell for coming on the podcast. It was great to hear his stories, particularly from the Portland days. And from Charlie, we go via a seamless link to another Portland artist with an affinity with the song Needle in the Hay. Portland Cello Project are a group of cellists with a mission to bring the cello to places you wouldn't normally see it and with music you wouldn't typically associate with the instrument. In 2014, they released an album called 2ES. It featured 6 covers of Elliot Smith songs, including Needle in the Hay, as well as 6 specially commissioned works. And I spoke to Douglas Jenkins, their artistic director.
Portland Cello Project started about 10 years ago as a group of cellists who are classically trained out here in Portland, Oregon, who also play other types of music, everything from, you know, like bluegrass to heavy metal to jazz to whatever.
Can you tell us why you picked Elliot Smith?
Well, I mean, the Portland connection is a big part. You know, we live in Portland, and Elliot is such a huge part of Portland culture and history and arts and everything that makes Portland as a wonderful place. And we've worked from the very beginning of the group. We've worked really closely with Larry Crane, who was a friend of his. And so we've had that connection, you know, working in studios that have some of Elliot's gear in it and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. His kind of his spirit has always been kind of in the background of the group, at least. We were working on a record, a totally different record with Larry, we were in the studio, and he let us hear a track of an unreleased song by Elliot called Taking a Fall. At the time it was unreleased. And I loved it. And I just had this, like, all these things went through my head of there's so much to Elliot Smith that I think a lot of people don't give him credit for in terms of the the compositional style and besides just the songwriting and the lyrics and his amazing voice and his amazing guitar playing, just the way it all meshes together is so complex on a compositional level. And that relatively simple song really sparked in my mind of what could we do something with just the cellos, make a totally instrumental that showcases that just as an experiment. And like, if no one ever hears it, no big deal. And, you know, there's over 1,000 pieces of music in our group's repertoire. So a lot of them get hammered out, you know, like I write an arrangement in 45 minutes or whatever, but that one I spent like a month on, even though it's 2 minutes, you know? And I kept bringing it back to Larry and being like, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And he'd be like, you know, Elliot wouldn't like the way you guys are playing it there because he always played to a click track. And like, what are you guys doing with all these speeding up and slowing down things? Like, and he really held us kind of like to task on a lot of that stuff. And like, kind of like reoriented my brain in that arrangement writing process to the point. Then we ended up with this 2-minute arrangement that I really love. It's one of my favorite pieces that we have, is Taking a Fall. And and with that, then it kind of just started the ball rolling. And it was over a couple of years that it took of writing these arrangements and rewriting them and throwing them out and writing and rewriting them, just as kind of like a bunch of experiments that turned into the 6 songs that you hear on the record.
You mentioned that that Larry Crane kind of gave you an insight into how Elliot thought and how he kind of wrote in his own process. Was there anything that you remember that you particularly learned from doing that yourself, that you learned about how Elliot wrote songs and put songs together?
Yeah, I mean, there was no shortage. There is no shortage of Larry Crane stories to tell, for sure, of about Elliot Smith. You know, he gets bombarded with questions from people all the time, and he's not someone who will like mince words if he thinks it's a silly question. So I just remember he's talking about, like, you know, he's a recording engineer. So people will be things like, what microphone did Elliot use on this song? And then, you know, Larry would be like, well, you know, we probably threw up this or that. And, you know, but the secret was the person standing in front of that microphone was Elliot fucking Smith. And like, so it's just like, you always got to bring it back to that. It's not, you know, you always, when you try to overanalyze things and you try to break them down into what made them be, at the end of the day, there was a human being that made it be. And that was a really special human being. And like, those are the things, like, you know, you can't quantify a lot of things about the music. And I think that's really what Larry took away. He would quantify what we were doing, but then he'd also unquantify what we were doing. He'd be like, well, Larry, you know, Elliot played to a click track. He always, you know, that's pretty much how he recorded. So you got to keep in mind, it's really rhythmically precise. I mean, even on those live recordings, it's so rhythmically precise, you know. And as classical musicians who play music that sounds a little bit more romantic, we tend to like do things that don't do what Elliot did with it. And so it was a big adjustment for us. And I think it still is. When we perform those songs live, there's still always like this recalibration of like, we're not playing Brahms right now, we're playing Elliot Smith, and what does that mean? And and I think that's really what we took away from Larry, is he never let us cut corners. He never let it be a gimmick. He never let it, you know, he always wanted to be in the spirit of the creation that he felt was accurate, that was, you know, genuine, that was in line with what Elliot might have thought. Although when we've talked about that too, I remember we were talking about that at one point, and Larry said, you know, if Elliot heard this, he'd probably just be like, what are you guys doing? Like, why are you doing this? And so there's always that humbling reminder as well, which is great, you know.
At the beginning of the interview, you spoke about Elliot Smith embodying Portland and the sort of the Portland spirit. What ways do you think he does embody that Portland spirit?
That's an interesting, I think, chicken or the egg question. Like, in what ways does he embody it, and in what ways has Portland been influenced by him, I think are two pretty big questions. Well, I mean, I just feel like, you know, when I'm driving down Division Street, I think about driving down Division Street as a song lyric, you know, stuff like that. When I live right by Alameda, and so it's like, you know, all the neighborhoods and the visions that come up with it. I'm thinking about the Rose Parade, right? Like things like that, which I was at just a couple weeks ago with my kid, and like just thinking about, you know, the shit on the ground from the horses. Like, it's just like, there's all of these things that are so evocative of Portland that he's put into his lyrics and created imagistically in what you're doing and what you're thinking about with it. There's the quirkiness, there's the honesty about how quirky the town is, but in a way that's kind of nostalgic about it as well, and that is also highly critical of it. I mean, I think you kind of have that complexity, which is why I think what makes that question so hard to answer. Portland's a complicated place, and it's evolved so much just since he passed away. There are things that I think he embodied about Portland that are still here now that are also just feel a lot different. And I wonder what he would think of it if he saw the California condos that are in Portland and stuff like that. Now it's just, it's definitely a city that's evolved. Division Street, holy shit, man. I mean, Division Street, when he was driving down it, and I mean, it was a completely different place. And now it's like, you know, really chic restaurants and condos and stuff. Like, it's literally changed that much. And it's hard for me to really like key into what he embodies about Portland, just since so much of that stuff is still there, but it feels a little bit transmogrified. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
That was Douglas Jenkins from the Portland Cello Project speaking to us there. And it's definitely worth checking out their 2ES album if you haven't heard it already. We're going to be sticking with the Portland theme now for our listener pick, which today comes from Sarah Robertson, who's chosen a rarer pick synonymous with his early solo career in the city.
My favorite Elliott Smith song is No Confidence Man. I first discovered it because I bought this little 7-inch at Jackpot Records when I was visiting Portland. And this song was split with, it was a double side split with Pete Krebs. And it was this beautiful little underrated song that had never appeared on any of his other albums, but was just so simple and had such depth to what he was trying to say and things that could be related to, whether it was a personal struggle or a struggle you had with a friend. The lyrics are so beautiful. The guitar is complex while also being so simple, and it just flows so easily. And I found myself listening to it over and over and over again. So it's quite unfortunate that it's not really appearing on any other services where you can repeat songs easily. And I almost love now getting up and having to move the needle back on my record player so that I can listen to it over and over and over again.
Thanks very much to Sarah for sending in her suggestion. If you want to be featured on the podcast, then all you have to do is send us a clip with your favorite song pick to info@myfavoriteelliottsmithsong.com. Now, we're nearly done for this episode, but I just wanted to quickly mention a tribute show we haven't spoken about before. It's happening on the 8th of August at the Brattle Theatre in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And at the event, there'll be a screening of the Heaven Adores You documentary, and there'll also be music from one of our former guests, Mary Lou Lord, who'll be playing with her daughter, Annabelle Lord-Patey. It sounds like a really, really great event, so I can highly recommend checking it out if you're going to be in the Boston area that night. So that's pretty much it for today. I promised I'd do it at the beginning, so here it is. Here's just a quick reminder that tickets for our own charity tribute show in London on the 6th of August are available for £8 on Facebook and Eventbrite. Thank you to everyone who's bought one already. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time when our guest will be the multi-talented comedian, actress and musician Margaret Cho. Hope you can join us for that one then. Lastly, thanks to all of our guests. Thank you to Elizabeth Wood-Stanley for producing this show with me. And thank you for listening to it. See you very soon.